So last year, I was invited to this event with Chick-fil-A to coach some of their leaders around the idea of creativity. And it was a really, really cool experience. And I think the brainstorming tool that I shared with them is really super helpful for any organization. So if you've ever struggled with the idea of feeling like, man, I'm not creative, or I don't know really the next steps to take with this next project or this initiative, maybe you're trying to come up with ideas and you're just feeling like it's just recycling the whole thing. And we've been there before, where you're looking at that blank whiteboard, just trying to figure out what's next. And so in this video, we're going to talk about really how to bust some of the myths of creativity, and then how to leverage this tool to really help you go to the next level in your business, whatever customer it is that you are serving. I just think this tool is a game changer. I think it's going to be super helpful. And we're going to walk through this step by step in this episode. Let's go. All right, so before we jump in today, I want to make sure that you see this inside of the show notes or the description, that you're able to download this PDF. It's called an empathy map canvas, and we're going to get to this in a little bit. It's a brainstorming tool, but I want to give you a little of the mindset and the foundation behind this framework before we kind of talk about how you can use it in your creative meetings, how you can use it on your team and in your business, and I'll talk about how I applied it specifically to Chick-fil-A in this particular example. And so make sure to download that. Check that out in the description. Whether you're listening on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or watching here on YouTube, you can download that, and we will get to that in just a second. Now, first, what I want to do is I want to go through really seven myths of creativity. And it's important to unpack these first. Myth number one is, I'm not creative. Maybe you've thought that before. You've said, you know what? I'm just not a creative person. And people mean a lot of things when they say that. Maybe they mean that they don't play an instrument, or they mean that they don't know how to do graphic design, or they're not an artist in some way, shape, or form. But here's the truth. Creativity is not an identity. It's an activity. So I'm not creative is not really an acceptable term, because creativity is not an identity. It's an activity. And I think, you know, we get kind of mixed up with this, because we'll even use creative like a noun. Like you talk about like the creator economy, right? What actually is a creative? But I think this is the most common lie. And I think it's a huge mistake, because people will say like, I'm not creative, and they'll say it like, it's almost like saying I'm left-handed, you know, like I'm not left-handed. It's just this statement of fact, or that I'm tone deaf or something of that nature. But creativity is not something that you are. Creativity is something that you do, right? It's a verb in its sense. It is an activity. It has action behind it. And so I think that's super important to understand, that creativity is not just this thing that you do have or you don't have, like it's this label that you wear. It's actually a practice that you develop. Like, being creative is when you are actively making something and putting something into the world, and it's something that you engage with. And so think about it this way. Like, if you would say, maybe I'm not a runner, like you wouldn't just say, well, I'm going to go out and buy new legs. No, what would you do? You would step into the arduous process of becoming a runner, right? I love how Nike, you know, unpacks this, because really there's an old mantra within Nike that if you have a body, you are an athlete. And so, you know, all different body types, like you might look at yourself and be like, yo, I'm not an athlete. But at Nike's core, they're saying, you know what, anybody that can wake up and move into activity, move into some type of physical exercise, whether that's running or whatever else it is, you are an athlete. I love the Nike Run app, because they even coach you through this, like having a running coach. And it's just this reminder, this mantra that you are an athlete. And so it's the same thing with creativity. It's if you wait until you feel creative, I promise you, you'll be unlikely to create anything. But when you see that creativity, being a creative, is not about an identity, it's about an activity, what you can do is you can actually make space for creativity to happen. You're not waiting for some kind of lightning bolt to strike you in the right creative moment, but you are putting action action and activity to your creative process. And so I think the most creative people that I know, they're not waiting around for creativity to strike them. They intentionally make time to do creative acts and to put creativity to action. They have made a practice, right, of showing up, making something, evaluating, reiterating, and then repeating the process over and over again. And so really at its core, creativity, again, it's not an identity, it's this activity, and it's a rhythm that you can build into your life using a pen, a whiteboard, a calendar, creative space to move in imperfect motion, but moving forward and making process. So if you've ever said to yourself, you know what, I'm just not creative, I would suggest to you, maybe you just haven't made something in a while. And that's okay. It's not a life sentence. You can change that today and move in the right direction. Now, number two, and I already alluded to this, but the number two myth of creativity is I'm not artistic, right? I'm not artistic. And here's the truth is that art is just one form of creativity, but real creativity is found in problem solving. And I think this myth keeps a lot of people on the sidelines because they've equated creativity with being artistic, drawing or painting or music or poetry or, playing an instrument. And so if you assume all of these things, you will write yourself off and say, well, I'm not very creative. But artistry is really just one part of the creative pie. And I want you to see this. Creativity at its core is being a problem solver. And the paint looks different for everybody. So I got a list here I want you to get through. Listen, so if you think through an artist, what they paint with paint. But depending on the industry you're in, a strategist paints with process. A counselor paints with empathy and questions, right? The right questions. A small business owner paints with systems and pricing and their staff schedules. Like a pastor paints with their words and the study of scripture and those sacred tensions, right? A marketer paints with language and copywriting and timing and tone. A parent paints with patience and discipline and leadership in the home and band-aids, right? Like on and on you could go. A teacher, right? A teacher paints with lesson plans and creating a healthy classroom culture and having creative illustrations and explanations. And a coach paints with feedback and the right drills and the right plays. Like it's all this sense of creativity that is not necessarily artistic. I mean, I use the example of my accountant, right? My accountant paints with numbers, right? Legally, making sure that I'm able to save as much money as possible within the legal confines of the tax law, right? Like your CPA is creative in that way. And so regardless of where you're at, if you said, you know what, I'm not creative because you've reserved creativity just for the artistic field, I'm telling you, you're missing out. You're probably much more creative than you think. And so instead of asking the question, okay, am I artistic? I think the better question to ask is, what problems am I trying to solve? Right? What problems am I trying to solve? And then what are the creative solutions for that? And so that's the second myth. Third myth is that, and this is a big one, is that creativity must be original. Creativity must be original. And here's the truth is that the best ideas are often remixed. Creativity is reimagining, not necessarily inventing. And so I think a lot of times when we think of creativity, we think it has to be something brand new, completely original, never seen before. But as it says in Ecclesiastes, right, that there is nothing new under the sun. And the reality is that some of the best ideas in the world are often reimagining of things that already existed, right? I mean, Spotify did not invent music. They were not the first music streamer necessarily, but they made it better. Airbnb. They were not the first company to do rentals, right? They just iterated a process that was better than everyone else. Apple. Apple did not invent the smartphone, right? It was an innovation. And so to think that creativity simply has to be original is missing the point, because some of the most creative things are actually innovations of things that already exist. And so the originality myth, I think the world is lacking so many incredible innovations because people think to themselves, well, that idea already exists. But there is just something out there that's maybe waiting for the remix. It's waiting for combining some of those old things and adapting one context to another. And I think some of the most creative things are actually when you borrow disciplines from one particular sector or one particular industry and apply it somewhere else. And so when you focus on being useful and you make it clearer, make it better, and iterate the process, it's a game changer. I love the musical Hamilton, right? Lin-Manuel Miranda. It completely changed theater, completely changed education in so many ways of embracing a creative process. But what is it? It's borrowing source material and then remixing it in a way that is completely applicable and appeals to a new generation. I think one of my favorite Instagram accounts, and I'll link it in the show notes to follow right now, is How Songs Are Made. And it has some of this archival footage and things from, you know, songwriters and when they're iterating in the studio. Like, there's this really incredible one with like Justin Timberlake and Pharrell where they're like trying to figure out his first solo album. But one of the other things that they do is they'll even go through artists that sample, like hip hop artists that sample particular songs from the 70s or the 80s, like these different synth pop bands, or, you know, looking back in different soul and reggae records, and how they'll take a little segment of that song and then rhythmically put that into a sample machine. And nobody does this better than Daft Punk. They're absolute geniuses. And, you know, when you look at how they built songs like Around the World, or they built songs like One More Time, and it's just the imagination, the remixability to take something that was one thing and make it completely something new, is creativity at its core. And so it's not just artistic, it's not just original, it's something where you're putting something out into the world that can be remixed and be a new expression. And so I want you to keep that in mind, that creativity can be something that you're reimagining. Now, myth number four, and this is a huge one, is that creativity requires resources. You might have said to yourself, you know what, we don't have the budget. Right? We don't have the money. We don't have the right people in house, right? We don't have the right people on the staff to be creative. And I think that's a myth, that creativity requires resources. Here's the truth. Creativity actually thrives under constraints. Creativity thrives at its best when it has limitations. You know why? Because when you have money, you can just buy efficiency. You don't have to be creative because you can just buy it, right? It becomes a commodity. But when you don't have money and you don't have a budget and you don't have a team and you don't have time and you have all of these limitations and you have constraints, what are you forced to do? You are forced to come up with fresh, innovative, reimagined ideas. Limitations, they force clarity. They demand creativity. And they create urgency. I'm going to say it one more time. Limitations force clarity. They demand creativity and they create urgency. Your best ideas will not come when you have everything. They will come when you have just enough and you have the courage to do it anyway, to move forward, to create action, to try something. And so, you know, you just think about even the content space. I'm in the content marketing space, and some of the most viral content in the world right now is shot on an iPhone with poor lighting, and it's just this happenstance thing, maybe something that just somebody put into the world. They don't have full film crews. They don't have, you know, these creators maybe have limited time or limited gear or limited budget. In fact, sometimes sometimes the more produced something is, the less of a chance it has to go viral. Why? Because it's just a commodity at that point, right? Like when you have the money and you have the resources, you don't have to be creative. You can just buy it. But there's something really, really powerful when you're thriving in limitation. You know, I come from the church space, and I think what a lot of people don't realize is that podcasting, one of the first early adopters of podcasting were churches. Now, you might ask why. Well, back in the day, and I'll link a picture in the show notes, what churches would do in order to kind of get their message out to their congregation, maybe somebody would want to record the message or the sermon from the particular weekend, they would have these like CD duplicators. They were like these old CPU towers, right? Just massive, massive units. And back in the late 90s and early 2000s, I mean, these things were expensive. I mean, these things were like $7,000-$8,000. And the average, you know, small, mid-sized church didn't have the resources to be able to use something like this, because, you know, just to be able to churn out like a handful of CDs, can you imagine that? Like, what an artifact. I don't even think my kids would know what a CD is, you know, but they would take the master CD and then duplicate it. And then it was, you know, it's the same thing that basically the music industry would use. It's a CD duplicator, you know, and that was something that required resources, right? That was a commodity until this thing came called the internet came along. And then there were new processes like broadcast.com and things where you could put audio online, and then later the technology behind podcasting, where essentially you can create your own radio show and put it up for free online, as long as you had the hosting rights and all that. You could put on that message for free. It was something that was completely innovative. That would have never happened if there wasn't a shortage of resources. It was limitation that bred that creativity. It wasn't that they were trying to be cutting edge. It was like, yo, how are we going to save some money? It's not in the budget to be able to buy this CD duplicator. Now that just sounds completely ridiculous. Like, right? It's just so ubiquitous that you would do that. But podcasting early on, those early seeds, many of the early adopters were actually churches. And so that just shows, like, at its core that, man, sometimes it's that shortage. It's the limitations. It's the constraints that force clarity, demand creativity, and it creates urgency. All right, number five myth is that creativity is individual. Creativity is individual. And the truth behind this myth is that creativity actually multiplies in collaboration. Creativity multiplies in collaboration. I think we romanticize this idea of the lone genius. I call this the Bon Iver effect. If you remember Bon Iver, the artist that was super popular, you know, in the 2010s, and his first album, you know, he locked himself away in a cabin in the woods, and it's this brilliant piece of art. It's this brilliant thing. You just think about, okay, the coffee is just right, and he's away in the Wisconsin winter developing this incredible art. Album and locked himself away in a cabin in this studio, and then emerges with this brilliant world-changing, you know, genre-bending kind of an idea. And I think we celebrate creativity like that in our culture, don't we? We think of, you know, those tortured artists like Van Gogh. We think of those artists like Picasso, and it's this incredibly like individualistic type act. You know, that creativity is something that is, the lighting is all moody, and, you know, maybe the coffee is strong, and it's like this pressure, this kind of creative burst that happens in a moment. And I think that we see it as this singular act. I got this little diagram here. I'm terrible at drawing here, but this is kind of the way we see it. It's like this singular, this one person. And when it comes to creativity, it's just all this creativity is just expanding out, right? It's just exploding from them. It's just, you know, it's this cinematic masterpiece. And the reality is that there are only a few of these creatives, right? There are those brilliant elite few that have those world-changing ideas that shape culture and change people's lives, and out of it shines all of their brilliance. And it's this individualistic act. But there's a different way to look at creativity, and it's creativity within collaboration. So whether that's in a small group or that's among a group of people exchanging ideas, exchanging feedback, beginning to dig into really trying to understand a process and understand the audience that they're trying to reach. And then out of that collaboration, they create new initiatives, they create new projects, they have those world-changing ideas. Now, what's crazy about these two diagrams, again, very crude diagrams here, but this is really a crude diagram of what would be the Big Bang Theory, right? That there was this, and I won't get into the science of it, but the theory states that, okay, there's this singular act, there was this singular random moment, and then creation sort of came out of expanding outward from this one moment of pressure, this one moment when the environment and the atmosphere and everything was just right, and then boom, creativity happens. And I think that culturally, especially in the Western world, this is the way that we look at creativity, that given enough pressure, given a studio cabin in the woods, given the right creative elements and all the right things, if they're just right, then it happens. It's less of a creative act and it's more like a detonative, you know, explosion. But the biblical view of the way that creation happened is more around collaboration. Because you look at Genesis 1, it says, let us create man in our own image. The first creative act done by God, it's within the Trinity. God the Father, God the Son, God the Holy Spirit. St. Augustine, he said that if you try to understand the Trinity, you'll lose your mind. But if you deny the Trinity, you'll lose your soul. And that's just a little theological piece there. But the point is, regardless of how you see the book of Genesis, creativity thrives best in collaboration. That even in that early narrative, it's painting this picture that it's not this one singular act. It's not just this one mind, one spark, one moment, one explosion. No, it's this whole idea of creativity within community. And so, you know, you think about the Trinity creates, the Big Bang, it detonates, you know? And I think about Pixar, and I think Pixar is celebrated for its creativity, its storytelling genius, and they use a structure, and you can dig into it, it's called the Brain Trust, where basically they create these feedback loops where ideas are pitched early on, they're critiqued, and then refined by multiple people again and again over time. By the way, if you're asking what are the best Pixar movies, to me, it's Ratatouille and it's Cars, and there's no debate about that. Bottom line, those are goated in my mind. At me in the comments. It is what it is. But Pixar is known for being a creative agency, right? They are known for being a creative house. And their whole structure is built around collaboration. When I worked at a church at the chapel, we had a staff principle called dream it, cook it, serve it. And I love this because the whole idea behind that is that you might have an idea where you're in a whiteboarding session or you're kind of in a thinking session. Maybe you've taken some time to retreat and you're coming up with a new idea for a ministry or for a particular event or for a curriculum or a teaching or whatever. But there was a second stage that was expected on our staff where it's that idea is never created in a vacuum. It's not acceptable for that idea to just be this singularity and then all of a sudden it's this brilliant genius that you came up with your own and you put into the world. No. Because oftentimes when that happens, the idea is not fully fleshed out and it is not fully cooked to be able to be served to the world. The bottom line is oftentimes when creativity happens in a vacuum, there are missed opportunities and the idea is not as good as it could be. It might be good, but it's not as good as it could be if it was not fostered and cooked in collaboration. And so there was this cooking phase that we talked about. And the idea was like, if you had a particular, idea or for a project or for an initiative, you were expected to have, you know, several iterations of before you would kind of present it to your leadership or, even after all that, like, you know, bring it before the larger audience, you would invite people to give you feedback, to poke holes in it, to ask all of the questions, to find the cracks and the places where it fell apart. And the reality is, like, I think sometimes when you use creative as a noun and less of a verb of an activity, sometimes creatives can be very sensitive and not want to invite other people into that feedback process. But the problem is we are missing out on the best versions of those ideas if we don't invite collaboration and for people to find the holes and to say, well, hey, have you thought about this? Or what about that? Or what's this chain reaction? And those collaborative meetings are best when you have people that don't think like you into those spaces to ask those questions. Not dream killers by any means, but people who are going to ask the real questions. Because when you go through that dream it and then cook it phase, by the time you get to serving it to the people or launching that product or putting that podcast out into the world or, you know, releasing that course or whatever it is that you're doing, you've gone through a cooking process where you've already answered a lot of the questions that people are trying to ask. And so I think that here's kind of the one-liner I want you to get here. Creativity thrives where feedback flows. Creativity thrives where feedback flows. You don't need just great ideas. You need great rooms where people feel safe to bring them, right? Having places where feedback can happen. And then when those ideas are pitched and refined time and again, that's when I think you will begin to see some more creativity. All right, so myth number six is that creativity is selfish. And again, this just kind of comes back to this idea of really the starving artist, okay? The creativity is the selfish act. I think about Rick Rubin, he's an incredible producer, and he talks about this idea of like, I don't actually ever think about the audience when I'm making music. And I think that there's certain value to that in the sense of, all right, I'm making something in a space where I'm going to be confident. Do I like it before I put it out into the world? But I would push back against that and say that, you know what? Creativity can actually best thrive when you're serving other people. So creativity is selfish. That's the myth. The best creativity serves others. And so there's this version of creativity that's all about self-expression, right? I'm a do this for me and you like it or don't like it. You know, there's an old movie making phrase that, okay, we'll make one for them, for the audience, and then I'm going to make one for me. And I think a lot of times in those creative spaces, it can really be inherently selfish, and it's about defending our art, and it's about defending our own self-expression. And I think all of those are incredibly Western ideas, but I think that kind of creativity stops short because it becomes this mirror rather than a window into our world. And so the best creative that I want you to look at, that we're going to pivot into talking about this tool that I think is going to be super helpful for your brainstorming that I taught some of the leaders at Chick-fil-A. The best creative work is empathetic, having empathy. It's looking outward to solve real problems for real people. And so, you know, again, I come from the church space. One of the most popular series every year, believe it or not, for most churches is when they do kind of a Q&A series, an Ask Anything series. Now, why is that? Well, because ultimately it's serving the audience. What are their real questions to real problems, to real applications that they're having in their life? Problem with so many churches is that they are answering questions that the normal person isn't asking. But when you're empathetic and when you lean into your audience and the people that you're trying to reach, there's something really powerful about being able to engage and answer questions that they're actually asking, right? I know it's a novel idea, but here's the thing. Creativity becomes powerful when it becomes service. And so when you move from this place of saying, what do I want to say, to what do they need to hear, your messaging and everything completely changes. I can't remember who said it, but I love this phrase in talking about Jesus of Nazareth. And they said this, that Jesus never sought to be beautiful. He just sought to be helpful. And I thought that was so powerful, because when you seek to be helpful and when you seek to serve, you're never going to be out of a job. You're never going to be out of work. You're going to be able to lean in to help somebody. And it's this difference between the artist who says, this is my vision and how dare you question my brilliance, versus a craftsman is somebody who makes something for someone else. And I think for a lot of us, when it comes to creative work, that's what I would challenge you to do. Stop being the artist that's having the concept album that nobody actually understands. And what if you became more like the wedding singer who writes a love song for a particular couple telling their story? One of those is self-serving. Another one of those is the opportunity to serve other people. And so creativity is not this selfish act. And I think that it comes down to when you think of yourself as a craftsman listens first. And I think with every team, with every organization, we have to have listening mechanisms in place to be able to understand the audience it is that we're trying to serve. And so very practically, like, surveys are kind of underrated, you know? Like, being able to do focus groups and understand the people you're trying to serve, those things are underrated, okay, in the 21st century. But I think what we've got to get to this place of is getting beyond being impressive, because you can be brilliant, but be disconnected and not reach anybody with your art or your creativity. And so, do you want to just be creative, or do you want to be helpful? And for one of those, I just want to aim to be helpful, because creativity, I don't believe, has to be this selfish act. I think it can actually thrive best when we're serving others. Now, here's the last myth, is that creativity is chaotic, okay? Right, when we think about the Big Bang Theory, right, it's this explosive type thing. It's that analogy of creativity that, boom, it just kind of comes out of nowhere, and it's all of this, it's creating out of nothing. And I would push back and say that creativity is actually not chaotic at all, but creativity thrives best when it has structure, and that systems can actually amplify your creative thinking. I think we've glamorized this messy, unstructured creative process, right? Late night brainstorming, like caffeinated 2 a.m. type stuff, like, you know, team no sleep, and like all this different stuff. And we mask it and we package it as creativity. Like, we love these stories of sketching out the next creative thing on a napkin sketch, or, you know, being this disorganized genius. And there's all these studies out there about, you know, procrastination, and, you know, creative people will, you know, are more likely to lose their keys, which I guess that means I'm creative because I lose my keys all the time. But like, we celebrate this idea of the disorganized genius, but I'm telling you, the creatives that I respect the most, the creative professionals that I respect the most, they do not operate in chaos. They don't. They operate in rhythm. They have systems. They have timing. They have a calendar, right? They have things in place. They have developed a process that has allowed their creative output to be repeatable, right? Even jazz, I'm in Kansas City, right? It's like one of the birthplaces of jazz. There are still rules to music. There's improvisation for sure, but they don't improvise randomly. They improvise within structure, and we have to begin seeing creativity that way, right? Even the most creative filmmakers, you know, they still have a shot list. They still have a run a show. There's still a plan. They still storyboard. Like, they're still laying things out. And I think when it comes to creativity and we hear something like systems or processes or optimization and all these things, we think it stifles creativity, when I would say it's the opposite. It focuses creativity. That the most creative people, like, I find that when I just take a moment to kind of clean the studio and just set everything right, like, you can have a great insight into how organized and how well I'm thriving by the condition of my car, right? I have an 8-year-old and a 5-year-old, right? Like I got the dad wagon going on, you know? And sometimes I'm not going to lie to you. It's a crazy, disorganized mess, right? There's a bagel that eaten on the way to school and we got to clean all that up. And it's just something about bringing order to that chaos that frees me up to think creatively. My friend, Dr. Manny Arango, just released this book in May 2025. If you're reading, watching this, it's called Crushing Chaos. And I love this because he pushes back against this popular theological view of ex nihilo, which means, created out of nothing. And he says this, that no, actually the way creation worked is that it's bringing order out of chaos. And that the reason that a lot of us don't have peace in our lives is because we are living in such a way that invites chaos and the invitation, right, of the life that God is inviting us to live in is to bring order to that chaos. And when you have those systems in place, creativity doesn't have to be this chaotic thing. It can actually be predictable and systemized in a way that allows you to really flow. And so that's the mindset that I want you to kind of get into your mind. And that's kind of part one of this. What if I told you that your voice could be the most powerful asset in your business? And what better way to use your voice than starting a podcast? In fact, a comprehensive podcast strategy could be the missing link in your business's marketing mix. But how do you get started and how do you make sure that it actually works? That's where my team at Made by Varsity can help. Made by Varsity is a full-service podcast agency that helps brands and entrepreneurs establish trust, build connections, and grow their business. So whether you need coaching and consulting to get set up, or you need turnkey solutions to manage and market your show from week to week, we've got you covered. Just head over to madebyvarsity.com and book a call with me today. All right, back to the episode. Now that we've kind of dispelled some of those myths, we've all been here before. If you've ever been on a staff or on a team, or you've gone into a project, you're trying to come up with a new idea for an event or for a teaching series or an offsite retreat or whatever it is. It doesn't matter what you're creating. It usually starts with like a blank piece of paper, right? And we go, okay, we're going to come up with a theme, or we're going to come up with an idea, or we're going to come up with, okay, what's kind of the call to action, or doesn't matter what it is. And it kind of goes something like this. We've got this blank whiteboard and we go, okay, now it's time to be creative. What do we do? And I think that we miss out on truly being creative in those spaces because we ask the wrong questions. And I think that when we shift this idea, and there's really a progression to this and talking about creativity and some of these myths that we unpack today, is that when you see creativity as not an expression, but you see creativity as a service of serving other people, then what you realize is that the starting point for creativity is not output, but the starting point is empathy. It's trying to understand the people that you're serving. And so the number one rule of communication and the number one rule of marketing, the number one rule of business, like you've got to think about who are you trying to reach and what problems do they actually have? What problem are you trying to solve? Right. So if you're in a service industry, white collar, blue collar, doesn't matter. Most of the time, if you're listening to this, you're probably serving people in some way, shape, or form, whether you're a teacher, whether you're an accountant, whether you're a pastor, whether you're a plumber, you own a small business, doesn't matter. And so I think that going back to that first myth that creativity is not an identity, it's an activity, I would say before that, real creativity doesn't just start with making, it starts with listening. It starts with listening. It starts with understanding the people that you're trying to serve. And so I'm going to give you something. You're going to laugh. All right. If you're under 35, you won't get this. But I call this the vanilla ice method. All right. It's stop, collaborate, and listen. Stop, collaborate, and listen. And so this is your permission. Go listen to Vanilla Ice right now. One Hit Wonder, whatever. Okay. But here's what I want you to see here is that this is a surprisingly deep framework, because when it comes to brainstorming, when it comes to problem solving, innovating anything, I have shifted the way I walk into these creative meetings or any kind of a, even like an offsite with myself when I'm thinking through a new project or initiative or what have you, is you've got to have these three things in place before you can really ideate or, you know, explore anything. Number one is that you've got to stop. Whatever it is. Now, this is the old adage, right? That you're so busy working in the business that you're not working on it. And the thing is that there are not often opportunities in most businesses or organizations to stop and get off of the treadmill for a second and take time to zoom out and reflect. So you've got to have time. You've got to have thinking time, right? My pastor used to say is prinking, like praying and thinking, right? You have to have time that you step back and you say, let's look at the whole thing. Like, let's zoom out. Let's look at it at 30,000 feet. And so do you stop, right? Do you Sabbath? Do you have a day, or do you have rhythms built into your calendar? Not just vacation time, but time where you're really thinking about everything that you're working on. When you think about the business, right? You think about what's next. You think about the next step. Like, do you have those times to step out? And the reality is for a lot of us, we don't, because it's always on to the next thing. It's the next client need. It's the next project. It's the next sales call that we're running. We don't stop long enough to realize, okay, what difference am I making in the world? The second thing is collaborate. Again, it's not this brilliant artist locked in the cabin studio somewhere. No, don't do it alone. Do you have mechanisms? And this all comes down to systems, really. It comes down to your calendar. It comes down to your team. It comes down to your office culture, whatever that looks like. Do you have mechanisms in place where you stop? Do you have places in, do you have things in place like that fosters collaboration? So again, this could be as simple as like a co-working space. You know, I was at the chapel for 5 years, never had my own office, right? Came from a culture where 9 years I had my own office, and it fostered one type of work culture. But then even just the fact of being in a co-working space where there was an expectation, a cultural value of dream it, cook it, serve it, something powerful about co-working spaces where you're kind of forced out of your own little 10 by 10 office to interact with the other humans, okay, right? That there's collaborative mechanisms. And so are you taking time to collaborate? Team members, whether it's volunteers, whether it's your customers that you're trying to serve, just those mechanisms in place. And then the third thing is listen. Listen. Not to your gut, but to your audience. It's using conversations and using opportunities to create, to really understand who you're trying to serve. Because again, when you see creativity as just this kind of creative explosion, what happens is it inherently becomes selfish, because you're just sort of listening to your own gut and your own self-expression rather than seeking to serve other people. But when you slow down, you stop, you collaborate, you talk to other people, and then you capture and you listen to what it is they are trying to say and the pain points that they have, you'd be surprised at how creative you could be. Because if you don't stop, you will stay stuck in your assumptions. If you don't collaborate, your ideas are going to stay narrow. They may not be the best that they can be. And if you don't listen, your creativity might miss the mark on the people that you're actually trying to help, right? And so I want to introduce to you a discipline called design thinking. And before we kind of jump into this brainstorming tool, and again, you can download that. It's in the show notes and the description. I want to talk to you a little bit about what design thinking is. Maybe you've never heard the term. Here's basically what the term is. It really actually comes from the technology world, from UI, user interface, and, you know, designing different products. And the whole idea is it's this crazy, it's a pretty simple framework, but it's all viewing, it's a user-centric approach. And so it's being adopted in everything from, you know, business strategy to education to leadership development and healthcare. And here's what it is. It flips the script. Here's what it is at its core. Rather than entering a creative space and just trying to come up with a creative solution, it starts with a person. Right? So instead of saying, okay, we're going to have this creative meeting and we're going to bring me your best ideas, right? I've done this. I've led meetings like this before. And trust me, they weren't great. I just asked people that were there, right? You got this blank whiteboard. You invite everybody in and you say, okay, we've got this event coming up. We've got this message series coming up. We've got this project, this initiative come up. All right, everybody, give me your ideas. You're like some king at the table. Bring me forth your ideas, you know? And it's not really serving anybody. You're all just sort of creative bantering, right? It's not really great for the iterative process. And the thing is that the results that it often produces are derivative, right? They're just rehashed ideas, recycled ideas, it's borrowed from other people. It's just, you know, it's copycat, it's commoditized. It's not actually really creative. Why? Because we're just creating for creating sake rather than being that craftsman of designing something for someone else. What design thinking does, and there's a whole, I mean, you can do all degrees and certifications in design thinking. That's not really the purpose of it, of what we're doing today. But the purpose of it is that, and I'll read this, it's a human-centered, iterative approach to problem solving that puts empathy at the very beginning of the process, not the end. So it's empathizing with the end user first, rather than just saying, okay, we made this really great thing. Do you love it? No, it's stepping back long enough to say, rather than saying, okay, what can we build? It's who are we building this for? What problem are we trying to solve? What is it that the person we're empathizing with, what is it that they actually need? And that's a completely different approach. And I think that this is really catching fire in leadership development spaces, and that's a little bit of my background with leadership development innovation, is that most organizations are great at executing their product, whatever it is that they do, their service. They're not great at stopping and collaborating, okay? They're built to go, especially entrepreneurs, right? Like you're built in such a way to execute, to do, to you know, kill it, drag it home by Thursday, okay? But when we step in and we talk about concepts like understanding. We talk about concepts like empathy. It sounds like therapists speak, right? But what design thinking does is it forces leaders to slow down long enough to ask better questions. Why? So they can make better decisions about what's next. Otherwise, we end up answering questions that no one's asking, creating products that nobody's asking for, and putting services out into the world that people don't actually need. And so then creativity, it falls flat because we believe in some of these myths about creativity. It becomes all about aesthetics, or it becomes about gadgets rather than what it actually can be, which is alignment. When you can have creativity, it's about alignment. You're aligning and you're thinking like a design thinker. You're aligning your solutions with the people that you're actually trying to help. And that's a game changer. Like when you really, really think about this, because it starts with empathy rather than artistic ego. And so I want you to take this take a look at this brainstorming tool again in the show notes and look at this, because I'm going to talk through this step by step with you. And we're not going to show, if you're watching this, we won't show it on the screen. I want you to kind of reference this because it's meant to be a canvas that you're able to go through with your team. I encourage you to get some Sharpies, get some sticky notes, you know, a whiteboard, because you can use this to iterate any process. You can use this as you approach any project, initiative, a project launch, a new, you know, offering in your business. You know, maybe you're designing your website, maybe you're putting together, you know, a message series or an offsite retreat, whatever it is. Maybe you're thinking about your onboarding process. You can use this for anything. And so what it is this is called an empathy map. And so we're going to use this as our framework today. And there's really kind of some major questions. And I'm going to talk about how I use this with Chick-fil-A specifically. All right. So here's the first thing, is that again, like I said before, creativity doesn't start with what it is that you want to say or what it is that you want to make. It starts with who are you trying to serve? And so this might be, you know, a new hire that's going through your onboarding. It might be a frustrated client that's trying to understand your service, right? It might be a single dad that walks into your store. Like whatever it is, you're kind of defining your avatar. You're defining your designed audience, your target customer. And here's what I want you to do at the top of that whiteboard or piece of paper, whatever it is that you're using. I want you to be as specific as possible about this person that you're trying to understand, who it is that you're trying to reach. Give them a name, right? Call him Derek. I don't care, right? Like Derek, 36, he's a single dad. Give him a vibe, right? Where does Derek shop, right? What is, you know, what sneakers does he wear? You know, understanding, getting like really visualizing them. And sometimes it even helps if it's a real person, right? And so if there's a particular client that you're working with or, you know, a person that you're trying to reach in your community, whatever it looks like, defining that actual person, not a demographic, but an actual person, and getting clear on the who. Otherwise, if you don't do this part, the rest of it's just going to kind of feel unfocused and shallow or scattered. And so again, what's their name? How old are they, right? What's a day in their life look like? What's their job? What's their routine? What's their social world look like? You know, what are they navigating emotionally, relationally? It's understanding who they are. Now, here's how I did this with Chick-fil-A. When I introduce myself, you know, typically when you're speaking somewhere, you know, you introduce yourself, hey, here's my family. And so I showed a picture of like me and my two daughters. You may not notice I'm a single dad. And, but I didn't tell them this at first. All I did was like, hey, this is my family, man. Super glad to be here. You know, I'm, you know, teaching this session. Thank you so much, you know, Ted, for inviting me, that type of thing. And so when I took them through the myths of creativity, I taught them exactly what I just taught you. And I just said, okay, we're going to do a little creative exercise today. And I want you to really to practice who it is that you're trying to serve. A big thing at Chick-fil-A is that every single person that walks into their restaurant has a story. There's this really, really cool video that they show in their internal training where they talk about like you have no idea how a chicken sandwich can mean something to somebody in a moment like that because you don't know people's story, right? You don't know that they maybe lost their job today. You don't know that maybe they went through a divorce that week. You don't know that they may be just struggling to make ends meet, whatever that looks like. Every single person has a story. So I took them through this empathy exercise, but I didn't tell them that I was a single dad. But here's what I said. I was like, here's what we're going to, just to practice this, we're going to say that this is a 36-year-old single dad, right? You know, he's, you know, working 50 hours a week. He's got, you know, two daughters, sees his kids on a 2-2-5-5 schedule, like super specific, you know, like laid it out. And what they didn't know was I was describing myself, right? You know, hey, you know, fights that tension between wanting to be as present for his kids, but at the same time wanting to be a provider, just laid out this thing. And then I had them ask a series of questions. And you can see this if you've got the Canvas. And again, you can just download it, download the PDF. And I took them through this questions process. And there's really several sections of it. Here's the first one. What is it that they need to do? So the definition of this is what action, decision, or task is it that does this single dad, do they need to accomplish? Notice we're not talking about chicken. Okay. We're not talking about fries. We're talking about people. Whatever it is that you're in business for, guess what? It's the people business. It's the people business. I love another one of the principles we talked about at the chapel that I love is called Power Hour. And it's based off of this thing from Home Depot. And Home Depot still does this to this day where they have every single work shift, they have a certain time, and you'll even hear them announce it over the PA. They say, okay, for the next hour, it's power hour. And what it is every single employee, every single person in the organization drops whatever it is that they're doing, whatever task they are focusing on, they stop. And what do? They go and they engage with customers and say, hey, how can I help you? What you working on? How can I serve you? Like, do you need any help? They stop that head down, you know, tasking, and they move to a place where they seek to serve. They stop long enough. And so they empathize with the customer. And so it's this question of, okay, what does your customer need to do? And so in Home Depot, maybe somebody needs to redo their patio that weekend, or, you know, they're feeling frustrated about, you know, what carpet to pick out. I don't know, like whatever it is. And so you know, I had, you know, the leadership from Chick-fil-A, again, using this single dad of Derek, 36 years old, you know, what is it that they want to accomplish? Well, every dad wants to have a meaningful experience with their kids, right? That doesn't feel forced. It doesn't feel awkward. It doesn't, you know, they want to be the best dad that they can be. Like, no dad wakes up every day and goes, you know what? I'm going to be a bad dad today. No. They wake up going, I want to be the best dad that I can be. And sometimes they feel so stretched in so many different directions, they don't really know what to do. But the end goal is they just want to be the best dad that they can be. And so we would have that leadership team or whatever project it is that you're working on. What is it? Okay, what's their end goal? What result would feel like success to them, right? What problem are they trying to solve? Now, from there, and this requires this next step. Sometimes this can cross into assumptions. I think this is why focus groups, why interviewing other people and having real conversations is super important. But the next question is, okay, let's think about that single dad. What are some of the things that they hear? So the definition of this is, what influences the things that they hear, the voices that they hear shape their thinking, especially the voices that they trust or the voices that they fear and that they hear in culture. And the reason why this matters is that we are all impacted by other voices. Doesn't matter whether those voices are on social media or in our real lives, it's the voices that you hear. And so what are their friends and their coworkers say about this issue? Like, what does culture say about it? What does their community reinforce? Like, what voices are they hearing from their co-parent, right? Like, what opinion matters most to them? What are the things that they're hearing the most? And the way I answered this, and again, I let them sort of iterate this process, but the way I typically answer this as a single dad is sometimes it's not what you hear, but it's what you don't hear. Being a single dad in culture, a lot of times, especially in education, like when it comes to like communicating with the schools and with principals and with the teacher, sometimes it's the lack of communication that speaks volumes. I had to go through this with Isla's preschool teacher, you know, for a long time when I relocated to Kansas City, because it took a little while. Like, hey, can you add me to the mom's email list? Like I understand that typically, and it's a gender roles thing, right? Typically, the communication happens through the moms, especially with preschoolers. Like, moms are preschoolers. Like, where's the dads? Where's DOPS? Like, where's the dads of preschoolers, you know? And I had to ask several times, like, hey, I need to be looped into this so I know what's going on, so that I'm, you know, looped into this process. And so sometimes it's the lack of communication. What do they hear? What are some of the things that they hear on a regular basis? When I went through my divorce, I was in full-time ministry and I had a, you know, platform as a, you know, public figure. And there was a, you know, time where, you know, church was growing, and I was meeting people who maybe knew that I had kids, and they would make an assumption, and they would ask, like, oh, I don't know that I've met your wife yet. And that was always a tricky question, you know, to answer, because it was based off of an assumption. Okay, if there's a pastor who's in leadership and who's in their 30s and they have kids, well, certainly they have a wife. And so that was something that I heard for a long time, and I would have to find ways to sort of, you know, navigate that question. That was something that I heard. And so, and you can really only empathize with your audience when you have those real conversations with them and engage them on that level. But again, what are they hear? So whoever it is that you're trying to empathize with, what do you think they hear on a daily, a weekly, a monthly basis? Here's the next question. What do they see? What do they see? What's their environment look like visually, socially, situationally? And because here's the thing, environment creates expectations, and what they see on a normal basis, it shapes what they think is normal or possible. When I became a single parent, I never noticed like family restrooms at an airport or at a restaurant. Being a single dad with two daughters, though, like young daughters, right, where like I have to sort of help in some ways, especially when they were toddlers, like that became a really big deal. Like, restroom facilities became something that I was keenly aware of that I never paid attention to before. Right? Some facilities are set up in different ways for that other facilities are not. we were just at a restaurant, actually just this past weekend, and we're at a steakhouse in town, and ordered appetizers, like food, like kind of did the whole thing. It's like kind of our Sunday night routine. And both my girls were like, we have to go to the bathroom. Yeah, cool, whatever. So we stood up, we went to the bathroom. You know, it took them a little while, like, you know, they had to go in. There was no family restroom. And so they went, you know, did their business. I'm just kind of chilling, you know, outside. And it took a little bit. It took like, you know, five or 6 minutes. We come back to the table and the bus boy is like cleaning up the food. We had ordered a bunch of different things, and the waitress, she looks frustrated and all this. And we walk back up and she realizes, like, oh my gosh, I thought you guys left. She literally thought that, like, we had, like, dined and dashed, like, that we had scarfed down a bunch of appetizers. The food hadn't even come yet. And the reality is, it was just one of those things. And I didn't take it offensively or personally, but it was one of those things of, like, wow, like, that was interesting. Like, you know, like, it kind of subverted the expectations a little bit, because, I'm just trying to help my daughters do what they need to do. But in that moment, like, that was an interaction that I think, you know, a normal nuclear family doesn't necessarily have. The point is that you see those things, right? Like, you go to a neighborhood park, or you go to a school function, right? And there's those complete nuclear families that are there, and a single parent, whether it's a single dad, a single mom, whatever it is, they see a completely different, you know, visual there. And so, you know, you see things on social media, right? You see these kind of picture perfect families. You see these Pinterest perfect, you know, tea parties, like whatever it else. And sometimes in a single parent's mind, some of those things feel out of reach, and there's the grieving of the things that were lost, right? So these are things that single parents deal with. And so, again, it's what empathy mapping is really about when it comes to this brainstorming process, is it's thinking of a very real person and sitting in their tension, right? It's experiencing what they experience and, you know, what they see in the world. The reality is, and again, this is not an episode about single parenting or you know, divorce recovery, but the reality is, for single dads, the resources are few and far between, especially faith-filled resources, right? There's just an assumption out there that, you know, dads are just kind of like, all right, you pick yourself up by the bootstraps and you push forward and you press forward. There's not the amount of community support that there may be out there for single moms. And again, that's not sour grapes. It's just reality. It's just what it is. And so that is one of the things that single dads see and experience on a weekly and a daily basis. So again, asking these questions: what is it they need to do? What is it that they hear? What is it that they see? Here's another one. What are some of the things you hear them say on a regular basis? So whatever audience you're trying to serve, what words are coming out of their mouth, whether it's publicly, whether it's in passing, it might be a self-deprecating joke. What it does is, see, what people say, it gives you insight into what it is that they're feeling, their pain points. And this is a big deal when it comes to, like, serving other people, because, you know, they get frustrated and they're just trying to make it happen. I work with, you know, business owners and entrepreneurs working with content. And at the end of the day, like a lot of them, they know that they're supposed to be making content, but they go, I just don't know what to say. Like, I hear them say this all the time. I don't know what it is that I'm supposed to say. I don't know how to unlock my message. And so this is what has led me to saying things like, and I say this all the time, you've heard it on this podcast, we often underestimate our expertise. So I tell them, hey, like, say what you would normally say, like, you know, in your everyday conversations, whether it's capturing a client call or, you know, sitting down for talking head or, you know, doing a podcast or whatever that looks like talk about what you're great at. You know, that's something that I would hear them say kind of time and time again. And so, you know, what do you hear them say? You know, since I moved to Kansas City, you know, a question that I get a lot, especially as you're meeting new people and that type of thing, is people ask, oh, you know, what brings you to Kansas City? And my go-to kind of rehearsed response now is, oh, I moved here to be closer to my kids. And that's true. Like, that's a question, and it saves some of the, you know, the details and the personal details that, you know, would be reserved for deeper friendships or deeper connections. But that is something that I say on a regular basis. And so, you know, I'm sure people, you know, jump to, you know, conclusions, or they have questions in mind, or there's kind of an open loop there. But that's something that, you know, I say on a regular basis. So when you're thinking about your target audience, or you're thinking about the people you're trying to reach, what is it that you hear them say on a regular basis? Right? Like, what are those phrases that come to mind? All right, here's the next couple of questions. What do they think and feel? So what's going on below the surface, and especially the stuff that they don't say out loud, right? And so when you do this and you really get to that empathy process, this is where like real insight begins to kind of crystallize and come into fruition, right? Is that our behavior is often driven by internal tension, okay? So being a single dad entrepreneur, here's one of the tensions that I face, just to be, you know, vulnerable with you for a second, is that being an entrepreneur is one of those things where it requires a lot of effort to get something off the ground, right? There's a sense of, I want to be able to provide for my family, and I want to be able to build generational wealth, and I want to be able to leave a legacy that's going to impact my grandkids and my great grandkids. But with that comes some late nights, and with that comes some sacrifice. I feel the tension of that future goal that I want to reach. Again, not for my own ego or because I'm trying to be famous or whatever. No, genuinely, at my core, my why is I want to be able to provide for my family in a way that is legacy building, that is impacting, right? But that's at tension with, I want to be fully present with my kids at all times. It's one of those tensions that I think single parents, especially people working single parents, feel, right? Is it's this tension of going, all right, I don't want to fail my kids. I don't want to miss out on these moments, but I also know that I want to provide for them in the future. And it requires a lot of trust in God in that process. What is it that they think and they feel? Here are great questions to ask around that. What are their fears, their frustrations, or the regrets that they're carrying? Right? What are their unspoken dreams? What are their pains? What are the blockers that they're carrying? And so you ask, what are their pains? That's the next question. It's knowing their pain points, because when you understand your audience's pain points, you can figure out how to build solutions to relieve tension that won't just sound creative in a vacuum, but it's actually answering the frustration and the pain point that they have. So you ask questions like, hey, what's frustrating them? What's getting in their way? What are they afraid of? Right. And so, you know, like it's time and efficiency, you know, so like being a single parent and in a lot of settings, like Thursdays are kind of crazy. Like we got swim lessons, you know, it's right out of school. It's jet to school. We actually go to Chick-fil-A. All right. Cause it's just like, you know, we're out until, you know, late past bedtime doing swim lessons, you know, and doing our whole thing. And everything has to go just right for that calendar to hit right. And so it's removing those pain points of like time and efficiency. And so again, it's those pains. And then the next question is, what are their gains? Okay, so this is their desires, their needs, their aspirations, which I already talked a little bit about, right? It's to, you know, build a legacy for the Chandler name, right? It's to develop generational wealth that's going to impact our kids, that there's still like, it's the best of both worlds. Well, the double win, not to just win in my work and sacrifice my family. No, like I want to be able to be fully present for my kids in every way that I can be, while having the freedom as an entrepreneur, while being able to build something that's going to be worth passing on to them, that's going to impact their kids, right? So it's like, those are the kind of gains. And so you ask those questions of what would better look like for them, right? What is it that they would want to feel or do or experience? What is the story that they are hoping to live into? And so, like, I want my daughters to feel cherished. Like, I want them to feel, you know, like the most important person in the room. I don't want to have a platform where everybody else knows my name, but I'm not famous in my own home. No, I want to be famous in this house first, you know? And so these are things that, you know, you're wanting these experiences, these things for your kids that they'll remember. And again, I'm using this example as a single dad. And so you take this, and this is what I told the team at Chick-fil-A. By the time they answered all of this, the group, you know, this particular breakout, it was maybe about 120 people in it, right? So, I mean, you're talking sticky notes on sticky notes on sticky notes, like so many ideas of, okay, what do single dads they need to do? You know, what do they hear on a regular basis? Like, what is it that they see in culture? What is it that you've heard them say before? What do they think and feel? What are their pains? What are their gains? I mean, by the time we answered all these questions, I mean, there were just hundreds of these sticky notes, like up on a whiteboard. And it can feel overwhelming, but after a while, you begin to see certain themes emerge, right? You start to see patterns emerge where you start to see tensions and you start to see common themes that, oh, I said the exact same thing. Like, yes, and it was crazy because in the room, you almost kind of feel this creative energy and friction where people are, it's that aha moment. It's that, oh yeah, you're 100% right. I have heard them say that. Or, man, I have noticed a single dad in line or a single parent that's, you know, maybe juggling multiple kids and trying to figure out the car line and all these different, oh, I have noticed that. And there's this almost rising that kind of happens and almost a fullness in their heart where they realize there's this power in empathy. And so when we walk through that map together, here's why I did this for Chick-fil-A. Is again, it was at this point that I actually revealed to them. I said, now what I didn't tell you before is that I'm Derek, you know, or the person we're empathizing with. Like, I am this archetype. I am a single dad, you know? And so all the work that you just did today helped me feel seen and heard and understood. Now, Here's the power of it, where it's not just some leadership exercise, but it becomes very, very powerful because every number has a name, every name has a story, and every story matters to God, right? There's two different scenarios here. Some of you may be familiar. Chick-fil-A's done this for many years. They have an event called the Daddy-Daughter Date Night, where they set up this really incredible world-class, you know, experience. And it's just a fun night for dads to be able to go out and have a memorable, special experience with their kids. And they've done this for many years. So I would say, so what I told them, and I didn't say that this is what I was setting them up for in this particular scenario, but I had them do this brainstorming process, this empathy map. And I said, okay, now, if I were to tell you to come up with ideas for the daddy-daughter date night, how much more creative are you going to be in this process now that you've taken time to stop, collaborate, and listen? To slow down long enough to think about an actual human, an actual person that's going through stuff, instead of what we usually do with brainstorming, what we usually do with creativity is we go, all right, we got to come up with some new ideas for daddy-daughter date night. What do we got? Maybe we should do trivia. Maybe we should do a princess theme. Oh, we need live music. Or, oh, wouldn't that be cool? Let's do a photo booth. Let's look up some ideas on Pinterest for a photo booth, right? Let's do a coupon giveaway. Like, let's, right? And so what happens is we're creating for creative sake. We're just taking the ideas, and it's not bad. There's nothing wrong with that, right? It's not bad to source ideas from other people, but it's missing something. It's not 100% connected. It's this surface level thing, and it's honestly what it is it's guessing at what would be a good fit or what would just kind of sound fun. And that's creativity without empathy. It's well-meaning, but it's disconnected. But the second scenario is when you go through a creative process like what we just did, where you take that same creative process and after walking through the empathy map, now you're not just trying to create for an event or for a category, you're designing it for a person. You're crafting an experience for a dad who deeply wants to show up for his daughter, who's probably navigating a full workload, who is navigating co-parenting and shared custody and all of these different things. And they're just carrying this quiet weight of, I just want to get it right. And suddenly, when you do that process, that whiteboard isn't just a blank canvas, but it's anchored, because then your ideas have this powerful reference point. So then you begin to think about that daddy-daughter date night in a very, very different way. And that's kind of the part two to the meeting. And, you know, what I would say is like, hey, I hope you'll do this with your teams, is because then it brings all the aspects of that, you know, particular experience into the creative process. So then you can ask actually the tactical questions of, okay, well, how would we greet them in a way that would affirm their presence? Like, what are some of the small touches that would make a single dad feel, you know, seen, appreciated, but not singled out, right? Like, you know, what are some of the things that we could provide, maybe conversation starters that would help that connection time with his daughter, like, be really, really meaningful? Like, what could the follow-up look like to reinforce that moment that, hey, you, dad, you matter, right? You matter in the life of your kids. Like, how could we design the space that feels really thoughtful and relaxed, that might even foster community between other dads that they're looking for community and looking for support? And again, that whiteboard comes alive because now you're leading with empathy. The execution then begins to flow naturally, because you're not just decorating for an event. You're crafting an experience that reaches somebody. And that's why I think empathy is the secret weapon of creative leadership. That when you step back for a moment and you don't just think about making things that look good, but you make things that feel right because they are designed for real people. Because when the person behind whatever project it is that you're working on is clear that creativity is not about output, it becomes about impact. It becomes about real people that you're trying to reach. And so you don't have to be in marketing to use this tool. You don't have to host events. You don't have to work at Chick-fil-A, right? But if you want to move past that place where you don't feel like you're just kind of throwing spaghetti at the wall, or in this case, throwing a chicken sandwich against the wall and hoping that it sticks. But if you lead people or you serve people, I'm telling you, this framework is a game changer. Like, it will change the way you do creative meetings, because the fastest way to creativity is often not better ideas. It's asking the right questions to serve other people. And so I hope the structure is helpful. You know, I think the next time your team, or you even say to yourself, hey, we need a new strategy. We've got to rework this process, or we need to design this experience. Don't start with the whiteboard. Start with this empathy map. Take a moment, step back. Let's dispel some of these myths about creativity. You are creative. Why? Because creativity is not an identity. Creativity is an activity. And when you begin to view it as a place of collaboration, you begin to view creativity as an act of showing up to empathize with other people, and you can sit in their tension and you can see what they see and feel what they feel, I think you would be blown away. And again, there are examples across any context that you can think about. So whether it's a church writing a sermon series, or maybe you're a principal trying to reimagine the parent-teacher process, maybe you're an operations manager and you're trying to figure out your onboarding process, or you're a coach trying to reach a burned out team, or, you know, you're trying to design a new experience to reach a new customer base. It works for any person, any project, any industry. That's the power of this design thinking tool. And so I hope that it can unlock some creativity for you. And I'm just telling you, what you don't need is you don't need this like creative pressure. I got to be creative in this one explosive moment. No, no, no. When creativity starts with empathy, you'd be amazed at the impact that you can begin to make, because those ideas become invitations, and the things that you are making and the things that you are creating, you're not just building something, but you're building something that matters. And that's a huge deal. And I love that you get to show up in that way. And so again, I hope you'll take that. I hope you'll take that brainstorming canvas, this empathy mapping tool that is in the show notes and the description below. Take that, go through your team. I'd love to hear your thoughts, your comments. Be sure to like, subscribe, turn on the bell for notifications, all the things. Thank you so much for subscribing. Hey, this was fun. Solo episode. Here we go. And let me know if you dig this format and you want to see more of this. And so let's not live in those myths of creativity, but let's show up as leaders with more empathy to lead our teams better and execute on the things that we're called to do in a big way. I love you guys. We'll see you next time. Hey fam, thanks so much for joining us on Making Varsity. If you enjoyed this week's content, make sure to tap that subscribe button, leave us a rating and review, and share this episode with a friend. For more resources, check out the show notes below or join me on YouTube. Love you guys, and I'll see you next time.